morning. Fake news has taken on a very different and political meaning. Today, contributing editor Neil Milner gives us a primer on news literacy for the real meaning. And in the wake of the Harm Reduction Conference, where leadership could go next, we'll talk with Chris Nierup, the lead National Support Bureau director. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Shangri-La, the Museum of Islamic Arts and Cultures, presents the work of a visiting multimedia artist from the United Arab Emirates. Mohammed Kazem is with us in our studio. And the Australian music production Dirt Song takes us inside the music, dance, and theater of a dozen indigenous South Pacific cultures.
It's Wednesday, January 18th. Yes, the Ledge opens in just a few hours. But first, the conversation after this news. Good morning, and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. You know, we now speak about consumers of news, and for the consumer of news, you can feel as if you're standing up in a rubber boat sometimes.
Very often, a rubber boat that has a big hole
big
on
hole
one side
it.
Of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and the question is, what do you do about it? First, you got to kind of know that you're standing up in that rubber boat,
right?
And it's got a leak in it. We've known that for a while, but how it's taken on a different connotation recently, well, that's our first conversation this morning. Now, for decades, you've probably seen them, those stories that arrive in your email with entreaties to take action before something is too late. And if you've been emotionally hooked before you check them out, say on Snopes, you've probably sent them along to family, friends, and coworkers. But fake news has taken on a political meaning lately, well beyond lies passed off as truth. Contributing editor Neil Milner is back with some help to help build your news literacy. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so let's just get right to it. Fake news now isn't just lies passed off as truth.
Well, what's happened is that fake news, like a lot of other terms, has taken on a kind of political meaning, and the meaning is anything that you oppose is seen as fake. And our new president, Donald Trump, is a master at doing that. Anything that he disagrees with, he'll call fake news.
Regardless of fact.
Regardless of fact. Fake news in the regular term, and I think the term is we're going to lose it out to politics, but fake news is basically lies that get passed off in various forms, more through social media, as the truth. That's basically what fake news is. And that's what we're talking about here when we're talking about ways to overcome fake news. That is, ways to get people to pick up the skills and, as I'll talk about, the attitudes that are necessary to be able to recognize fact from fiction.
First, it would seem that you'd have to have the attitude of understanding that fake news has to do with fact and fiction, not just opinion.
Well, that's right. Everybody quotes Moynihan's, the late Senator Pat Moynihan's view that everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but they're not necessarily entitled to their own facts. If it were only that easy, because facts and opinions get merged. But I think the attempt to change fake news, to overcome the fact news and to get people to assess information better, and there's a whole lot of it now nationally and so on. And Ann Ullman teaches a course in which it's you learn it at the university.
And her students have just put together a 14-point
yes.
checklist. So if you want to know what fake news is, this can help you.
That's right. You can. The real challenge is that teaching people how to assess news is not like woodshop. What it really in woodshop, it's all about skills building. Yours isn't very much about what your how much confirmation bias has, what your predispositions are. When you're teaching something about learning to assess the news so that you can tell fact from fiction, truth from lies, so that you can assess it, there's really two things going on. There's that kind of skills that you need, and a lot of these lists, including the list that Ann Ullman have, go along those lines. How do you assess? What do you look for? How do you tell if it's authoritative? This is especially on social media. The real challenge is that we're up against the idea that people have very strong predisposed notions about how the world works. And in some ways, when you're teaching folks to learn how to assess news, you also have to understand two things, one of which is that there are lots of people who don't want to do that. Really, three things. There's a second thing. When they try to do this with kids, they discover kids don't know what news is. They ask a question, what's news? They didn't really know. But the third thing is that we carry with us a strong sense of values, as I've talked about before, that predispose us to want to believe more things than others. It's a whole lot like teaching.
Right. So it's got to get through your own bias and filters before you pay attention to it. So then what's to be done to combat fake news in its new meaning?
Well, and it's you mean in its new – well, first of all, to understand if the first thing you want to do is to understand how the term fake news, the way it's defined, is itself fake news. When Donald Trump says CNN produces fake news because it disagrees with what he believes, one of the little check tests you can give is, why is that fake news? I mean, isn't it just that we disagree on how to interpret a certain sort of thing? So that's the first thing. If you look at how these courses work, and there's courses for students and there are courses for journalism, at the same time, they're explicitly focusing on building the skills, learning things that would seem, you know, learning things that involve, where did this person get the evidence? What's the website like? You're essentially trying to socialize them into being more self-critical, into examining their own ideas as well as examining the ideas of others. And that's where the real challenge is, because we know how hard it is to persuade people, and we know how insidious rumors are. If you just keep repeating rumors really do take on a power of their own. So that's really what the challenge is here. And it remains to be seen whether these courses are going to be able to – how good a job they're going to be able to do this.
Media literacy within the greater context, what you've just been talking about, making it incumbent upon people to find out, to go and seek out information, ask the question, why is this true, why is this not true, and how do we know? That's one part of it. But what about media itself?
Well, there's a couple of things going on there, too. First of all, the media is very different. I mean, that's just the you have the explosion of social media, and you have, in a sense, the shrinking of traditional media. There are more and more newspapers have cut back on staff. It's harder to find people who are politically experienced who know how to write about this. So that's one problem. Part of what news organizations are trying to do is to figure out ways to assess these kinds of tweets, these kinds of things in a quicker manner. That's pretty hard to do. One of the ways you do it is to you constantly upgrade your website. So that's one side. The citizens media, the citizen literature is on the other. But they're still based on the same notion of assessment. Now, professional news people are socialized and understand it's part of their ethic that what you're doing all the time is being skeptical of information. You have to find more sources and so on. That's the same thing you're trying to do with your average person if they're interested.
Who may not be predisposed to doing that at
all. That's right. One may not be predisposed. Two may not read at all. Or even
have the time to do it. I mean, people say, what? You don't – the trust factor that we've seen erode for the last decade or so especially – with people may not lead them to want to go to media sources in the traditional sort of way.
Oh, that's right.
So what happens?
They don't. It isn't even may. They don't go to the media sources in a traditional way. Yeah.
But even the media sources that are on social media, people who are looking for alternatives and who want something that they can trust so they don't have to go through all this constant proving of is it right and do I know and how do I – although those critical thinking skills that have been also eroded over time – could use a little bit of shoring up. A lot of people feel that way. I know you do. But what happens then to media as it's summarily told it's fake news because someone has an opinion that disagrees with what they're putting out?
Well, that, the media just has to figure out a way to fight back. I mean, that's essentially what they're doing. When you some of this tension with between Donald Trump and the media is based on the saying that we're not going to let you get away with this. It's a tough one to answer because it's not simply about responding in a neutral sense. It's about trying to speak truth to power when power isn't very interested, and also trying to speak truth to a lot of other citizens who may not be all that interested in it either. I think that part of the real difficulty here is that it is so easy for people to get so many sources of information so quickly, especially since they tend to search in things that they look for.
By agreement.
It's very simple. This is how fake news gets created, one of the ways. And you see how simple it is. Guy wakes up in the morning. He's a highly partisan guy. He writes a 200-word story about President Obama that's totally based on rumor and innuendo, puts it on his website, tweets it. His website's got a lot of regular followers. It goes viral, and there isn't any kind of checking. I'm amazed, even sitting among my friends who are liberals, the way that they would grasp onto just the goofiest anti-Trump information during this campaign, because it's just so tempting in a polarized atmosphere.
Which is to say, it cuts both ways.
It does cut both ways. Well, yes and no.
We don't often talk about that part.
That's right. But clearly in this situation, there is no question that the alt-right and that the let's call it ultra-conservative, has been much more have used this thing much more. This is, in some ways, this is where Andrew Breitbart from the Breitbart Report really got his start in doing this kind of interpretive fake news.
All right. Well, we're going to see what other things come out as fake news or as term fake news and give us some more to talk about as we move through. It's going to
we'll
get more
have no problem finding it.
I don't think so. Exactly. Thanks very much, Neil.
Sure.
Contributing editor Neil Milner joins us every other week for a look at the long view. We've posted a Poynter Institute primer on protecting yourself from fake news. It's on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
On Friday, Donald Trump becomes the 45th president of the United States. He'll take the oath, and NPR News will be there, carrying his inaugural address live to the nation and also following the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue. I'm Steve Inskeep. Join Audie Cornish and me for all the festivities. Special coverage of Inauguration Day from NPR News.
Friday, beginning at 5 a.m., right here on HPR 2.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:16. Coming up, a multimedia artist looks at the rapid changes in his homeland. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a woman who was one of the world's most celebrated heiresses, generations before Paris Hilton. Wealthy young women were magnets for mass media in the roaring 20s, and the one we're thinking of today was reputed to be one of the wealthiest in the world. She was an heir to an East Coast tobacco fortune. Yeah, you know who we're talking about. She first came to Hawaii when she was 20 years old on a world tour with her first husband. She bought 5 acres of shoreline at Diamond Head and turned it into a combination vacation home and museum, indulging her passions for horticulture, architecture, and the art of the Middle East. Her estate eventually housed more than 35,000 pieces of art from around the world. The legacy of her vast fortune is continued today by a charitable foundation dedicated to medical research, prevention of cruelty to children and animals, the performing arts, wildlife, and ecology. This morning we're looking for her name. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you get the prize.
I'm Richard Walsgrove from the Center for Island Climate Adaptation and Policy. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
All nations seek rapid economic growth, and the faster the better. But what happens to age-old customs, spiritual practices, mores, when a society is hurled into the future? That's one of the questions asked by multimedia artist Mohammed Kazem, artist-in-residence at Shangri-La Center for Islamic Arts and Cultures, in his work. It's what he, part of what he'll be discussing in a night shift artist talk there tomorrow night. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us.
I'm very glad to be here.
You started in art, the art world, as a painter, but you've expanded since, right?
Yeah, I've been started as a painter since 1984, influenced, in the fact, by European traditional art in the beginning. Then, naturally, I went through also the experimental work with using different materials.
There was a lot of that in the art world at that time, wasn't it? A lot of encouragement to go beyond your borders, I would think.
Yes, I think you cannot just stand in one place, and you have to move, because there's history of the art, which we have to go through that. Then we have to, when you came to the, I came to the contemporary art, which is... I have been influenced through many different schools. In most of them, they were European school of the art. But then, I also practicing as a criticizing myself in order to develop my own tools.
Sure.
And make some new work with using different material and different media. And generally, I used to make. I do not have any plan when. When I came here, I usually try to capture the elements which are surrounding here in the city of the Hawaii. And this is, for me, it makes sense to see the elements in the social life, in the nature, like lights and movement, sound of the city. So I put all those elements in the context of my visual art.
So you kind of come with a clean slate, as it were, and then absorb whatever there is to absorb.
Yeah, and the fact that also I'm working with a GPS. Which is
GPS locator, electronic locator system.
Yes, but I'm giving the GPS different function in my practice. So sometimes I draw with the GPS, sometimes I raise a political issue with the GPS, sometimes I use them for raising many different issues in my practice. Here I felt that I might go to use the coordinates of the artists whom attending the show, which are coming from different directions to meeting point here in Hawaii, then I might go to use them as through the light, through the nature of the light, or to use those coordinates to throw them back to the sea. So here I'm using the technology. Besides of that, also I'm using the nature elements like the waves and winds to take those coordinates in order to cross the border.
So the coordinates emerge as a number series, right, which can be used to, as you said, to draw, for example?
Yeah, I can to draw. Some of them I made a work which called in the exhibition curated by Dr. Dorothea von der Kolen in Germany. Is that the theme of the show is when ideas become form. So I stand with the GPS in three locations. So I received that different coordinates from three locations in order to make triangle shape. So here I'm using for drawing the shape. but it's, it doesn't have that systematic way when I do the work. So I use them as a material. And I can give you an example of all these coordinates, which I'm using since 99. So it's became kind of the raw data in my in the GBS itself. So I'm using them. Sometimes I manipulate with them, but most of them it's quite very minimal and very sharp when you look at to my work.
Well, that's an example of adapting to a new medium, because there was, when you were training as an artist, there was no such thing, right?
No, you don't know. I mean, I think I use even the conventional
latitude, drum, longitude,
like if it is necessarily to support my contemporary work.
Well, at the same time, you sound as if you're a real student of the history of art. Is that necessary to? Is that important?
I think it's very important to know what's happened in the history. I mean, for me to know, I went through all this traditional European painting. So that's why I'm able to tell you, even my contemporary practice is referring to the conventional painting, even on sculpture. So I'm trying to fill the gaps, which is between these two things. So in my work, also, you can see the composition is there, the morphology, which is a traditional work, it's there. So I'm using also those traditional. I have still Impressionism eye in my work.
So it still informs what you do.
Yes. So I think all this, I cannot, example, forget the theory of the color, which is written by Johannes Etienne. So the strength of the colors and all those materials I'm using in my practice.
Picasso once said, "To imitate others is necessary; to imitate oneself is pathetic." Yeah. Right? Don't repeat yourself.
Yeah, you cannot repeat what's happened, but in the fact we are, and somehow we are repeating it in a different way and trying to provoke the different topics and to add something.
Yeah,
yeah. Because when you start making art in the beginning, so you have to go through them.
Sure,
you have to go through them. But by the time you have, also, you are criticizing yourself. You feel that you have to do something different or something unique, which is referring to your thought. So my work also has a variety of way of making artwork. It's not traditionally, when you look to the painting, you can refer it to some artists. But because I'm doing kind of the anti-style, so with using all these materials, so the harmony, it is in my thought, in the fact. It's not in the just piece of the art.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Multimedia artist Mohammed Kazem is Shangri-La's artist in residence until January 22nd, and on Friday evening, he'll preview his work during the museum's night shift program.
Hi, this is DJ Mr. Nick, host of Bridging the Gap. One of the things I love about the islands and Hawaii Public Radio is diversity. At HPR, our goal is to bring you a variety of viewpoints from voices you might not have otherwise heard. Public radio lets them speak for themselves so that you can draw your own conclusions. It's smart, like you, and listener support makes it possible. Become a member today. Renew or increase your contribution at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
A counselor who was involved in a school sex scandal case now works for the state. How did that happen? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So what do we know about social worker Scott O'Neill and his time at the Hawaii Center for the Deaf and Blind?
Well, this story comes from John Hill, and back in 2013, the Department of of Health was looking for a social worker. They wanted to hire this person to manage cases for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And so they hired Scott O'Neill, who was working at the School for the Deaf and the Blind. And turns out there was a federal class action lawsuit filed against O'Neill, as well as the principal of that school. They say the lawsuit alleged that the two officials failed to stop a sex abuse ring, if you will, between students, older students robbing, bullying, and raping younger students at this very same school. O'Neill settled the case for $750,000. He got insurance to cover it. He's always denied the claims, but he settled because he wanted to avoid, you know, the time and expense of litigation. But I think the question that's raised here, the reality check is, should the state have hired that person? And then, even more interestingly, what happens if you're innocent but named in a lawsuit? Does that brand you forever? And that's one of the compelling questions, the reality check, if you will, this morning.
As we talk about that question, because it has come up in other cases, in other situations,
sure.
And in this one, you know, people hear the words, you know, sex scandal or sex case at a school, and there's an emotional response. But
school for deaf and blind.
And to add insult to injury, exactly. But when you step back from that, it kind of goes to our first segment this morning with Neil Milner about looking and saying, you know, why do we know this is true? What do we know about it? And that seems to be what happened with the Department of Health, because they also knew that he had been involved with a case, did they not?
They did, but they didn't get full access to the DOE, Department of Education records, or the court records. They didn't look any further. His references were solid. Scott O'Neill here, his performance has been good while working in the Department of Health. O'Neill himself told our reporter that, you know, he knew nothing about what was going on. That said, there was at least one person who complained at the school who said that Mr. O'Neill maybe didn't take the complaint seriously enough. We should say that the state, our state, settled for $5 million to compensate the victims in this case. They wanted to settle it and move on. The principal, by the way, who was also accused, he's now working at KCC as a student specialist, Kapiolani Community College. So there's another individual named in the case. By the way, three juveniles were charged. We can't reveal any more information because at the time they were underage. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so at this point, this man gets to move on with his life. Potentially both of them do. And with solid references, should we ask ourselves, why are we raising eyebrows?
Yeah, at least one disability expert in town said, boy, it does raise eyebrows. The story's a good one. It's up on our website right now.
All right. Thanks, Chad. We'll talk to you in the morning. Or
thanks,
I'll
Bethany.
Actually see you down at the ledge later on.
Yes, you will. You probably will. Opening day.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. We started the week with a conversation with a neuroscientist who was the keynote speaker at the recent harm reduction conference. Since then, those advocating for harm reduction in Hawaii through a hui of 25 local organizations and LEAD, which stands for Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, sat down with the deputy managing director of the city and county of Honolulu and a representative from HPD. We're circling back this morning to see how that meeting went and where harm reduction leadership could go from here. Chris Nurup is the LEAD National Support Director at the Public Defender Association in Seattle, Washington. He's been here for the conference and this week joins us today. Thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
You're from Seattle, where all of this began, and you've traveled to other places where harm reduction movement has been growing. How does what you see in Hawaii and what you've been experiencing over this last week compare to other places, including Seattle?
I'd say it's really quite impressive. The service environment here is very rich, much richer than I've seen it in other places. So in terms of implementing a program like law enforcement assisted diversion, which relies on very good services, I think the infrastructure here is well set up. I haven't sat in on the hui yet. It's going to happen later this afternoon, and I'm certainly looking forward to that. And it looks like there is sufficient political will and leadership to bring this about.
So the service providers and what you see in terms of the range of services in Hawaii is more than what you've experienced even in Seattle?
Well, Seattle's a little bit richer, for sure, because we've got a much longer history of doing stuff like that. But Hawaii is much better positioned than many of the locations that we've worked with.
Why? Where,
For example, much better than Santa Fe, New Mexico, or Albany, New York, or Fayetteville, North Carolina, which are some of the other jurisdictions that we've worked with. And I think it's because there's been good leadership here, and people of good faith have really been working hard on these issues for several years.
And the composition of the people themselves. I mean, we always talk about how Hawaii is a very different environment than Fayetteville, than Albany,
yeah,
than Santa Fe.
Well, I think that the people with a real vision and fortitude who have been working hard on these issues. I mean, obviously there are issues here that are somewhat unique, and I know that the housing issue is something that is really very significant and will be a big hurdle to overcome, but that's true in other locations as well.
So at this point, what do you see going forward that looks like a prudent course of action that's doable, that's really doable?
So I think for a situation like Hawaii, specifically here in Honolulu, if they were able to get the police department and the prosecutors and other relevant stakeholders to all agree to move forward with law enforcement assisted diversion, picking a specific neighborhood to pilot it in and starting off relatively small and then building it to scale over time would be the best course of action.
You're really talking about how do you address those low-level drug and addiction crimes,
exactly,
prostitution, things that don't necessarily have to wind up in jail, or according to many local advocates here, certain notable ones who've said that's where we should have gone a long time ago.
Absolutely. I mean, it's crazy to deal with this through the criminal justice system. Dealing with behavioral health issues such as substance use or mental health through the criminal justice system is not just not effective, it's actually counterproductive, and it worsens the situation in many cases. I've spoken with sheriffs who run jails in parts of the U.S. who say, I became a sheriff to deal with public safety, not to be a social worker or a mental health counselor. I'm not trained to do that. I don't know how to do it, and I know I'm making the situation worse by putting people in jail.
And having the revolving door of in and out and in and out and in out.
Absolutely. And it makes communities unsafer. Because
and costs them a lot of money.
And costs a lot of money.
At this point, when we have a change of administration happening in less than 2 days, and looking at some of the issues that LEAD and other organizations, certainly some of the HUIs, some of the members of the HUI in town are deeply concerned about where money is going to come from and how they're going to be able to move forward. Does this make you feel like you have to sort of dig into the trenches a little bit more strongly?
Yes. The one nice thing about LEAD is that it can all be done at the local level. Donald Trump, Jeff Sessions, doesn't matter who's president or attorney general, they cannot tell a local police department or a local prosecutor who they have to arrest and who they have to prosecute. This change can all be done at the flip of a switch at the local level. The funding is an issue that is of critical concern. We use Medicaid dollars, Affordable Care Act, to pay for the chemical dependency treatment, mental health, and regular health care of individuals who are in LEAD. That is in severe jeopardy.
And in Hawaii, that could be a very big issue.
Absolutely.
So on one hand, there's the opportunity for Hawaii to stand with its ideas and values, depending upon whatever they may be, or to take this on as a state initiative or as a city and county initiative throughout the state. On the other hand, there's going to be always that issue of money.
Of how to pay for it and how to leverage those resources. And that's something that we will be looking at with many of the jurisdictions that we're working with. So, for example, in Albany and New Mexico, they are also using Medicaid dollars to pay for the rich array of services for folks that are diverted into LEAD. And it's a conversation that's going to have to happen.
What are the alternatives? I mean, you're talking about private foundations, additional monies that are brought in?
Private foundations or leveraging in some areas. So, for example, the state of Oregon actually has what they call a justice reinvestment system, where if local jurisdictions can prevent people from going into the criminal justice system, they can get that savings back.
Well, we had that, too. We haven't seen the kind of success that was sort of promised with that, but certainly the road has been paved.
Aha, I was not aware of that. So that's definitely something to try and leverage some of those dollars back. Locally in Seattle and King County in Washington, we have a 0.1% sales tax, which is dedicated to mental illness and drug dependency, is something that locally we voted to enact, and that is what's paying for LEAD in the, right now.
We already have part of our GET in Honolulu, on Oahu, going to the rail. People have tried other additions to that for very important purposes, education, et cetera, but those have failed.
Uh-huh.
Is there a way that you think that we need to look at this differently, perhaps, than we have in the past? Because people hear any sort of addition and think, okay, it's another tax.
Right.
But what's the alternative? You're going to pay for it one way or the other is what I'm really hearing.
Exactly.
Say.
And so one of the things that I would bring up that I've learned from the several days that I've been here and talking with local stakeholders is that there is very serious conversation about building a new jail. And this was something that we were facing in Seattle when we were considering implementing law enforcement assisted diversion. And it turned out that we only needed to reduce the average daily jail population by a relatively small percent to get away with not building a new jail. And that created the incentive and to both go ahead and do LEAD, but also to provide financial support for it. It's cheaper than building a new jail.
Ours is crumbling, though. There are issues with that, too. But uh-huh. You're saying that in terms of what kind of jail you might build, who is housed where.
Exactly.
And we've been dealing with that and having conversations. And through what you've been telling us now, no doubt more of them will come. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Chris Nurup is the LEAD National Support Director at the Public Defender Association in Seattle. Again, LEAD stands for Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. He's worked on LEAD program design and implementation since 2009 and has done technical assistance for jurisdictions interested in implementing their own LEAD projects. He came to Honolulu to participate in the recent harm reduction conference and the meetings afterward, including with the HUI of 25 organizations later today.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lahm and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, you got robots. I love robotics.
I know. We all love robotics. And,
I know.
You know, we got to take a look at a new competition that just happened at the end of the year called Robot X, which was actually a maritime robotics competition where they actually built these boats, these vessels that were pretty much autonomous, and they had sensors all around them that allowed them to maneuver through the obstacle course that they put together out over by Sand Island. So that was kind of interesting. And University of Hawaii participated, and they have a team that is focused on building the next version of that boat that they had out on the water. That competition is going to is every 2 years, and this one is going to be, I think, in 2018. But we wanted to get the team lead on the show and also the assistant dean over at the College of Engineering and talk a little bit about this program called Robot X.
I can just imagine what that's like to see these autonomous marine vessels, right? They call them on the surface. That'd be great.
Yeah, and, well, you know, we're all talking about or hearing about these self-driving cars and things, and, you know, sort of this is the beginning of the work that goes into a self-driving and self-navigating vessel, right? So interesting stuff happening over at UH.
Yeah, take a self-driving car and throw in waves and currents. That really is.
Yeah, and salt water.
Exactly. Thanks a lot, Bert.
Okay.
That's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m. In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a celebrated heiress who made her mark on Hawaii through her philanthropy and her love of Islamic art. Her five-acre Diamond Head estate is home to more than 35,000 pieces of art collected on her travels, and her charitable foundation continues its efforts in medical research, prevention of cruelty to children and animals, the performing arts, wildlife, and ecology. She was a close friend of surfing legend Duke Kahanamoku and his brothers, who were frequent visitors to the estate she called Shangri-La. Under their tutelage, she became the first non-Hawaiian woman to take up competitive surfing. Today, Shangri-La is filled with memories of her colorful life, and you can visit its collection on tours booked and conducted through the Honolulu Museum of Art. Her name, of course, is Doris Duke.
And Jerry Yakimashi called us from Volcano, knew the answer, and is going to get the prize, although I understand our switchboard lit up and lots of people were going to be runner-ups very easily.
Yeah.
That's the Backyard Quiz for today. If you've got one for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're coming up to 8:48.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2017 Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations are February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Dirt Song is a musical production from Australia that's coming to Maui and the Big Island and Oahu over the weekend. It will communicate to you in languages you've never heard before. It's sung with some beautiful choral harmonies in the indigenous languages of what is now Australia. It's a production of Australia's Black Arm Band, which describes its work as Aboriginal musical theater. Shelley Morris, who's been at the group for 10 years, is on the phone with us from Maui. Good morning, Shelley.
Good morning, Chris.
And you're also the author of that beautiful song we just heard.
Not that song, but I am the author of a song
Dirt
called
song.
Rainstorm.
Yeah, I was listening to that this morning. It's wonderful choral harmonies in that. Beautiful use of
absolutely, yes.
I think the human voice is still the winner in terms of communicating emotion. It's what all the instruments try to do, right?
I totally agree with you there, Chris. And allowing that emotion to come through, especially in a show like Dirt Song, we are communicating the story of the land through our song.
A story that was long overlooked, right, Shelley?
Very much so, especially by the colonizers that came in. Of course, in our culture, it has never stopped.
Yeah.
And but unfortunately, we were just at the land, and our people were so connected. There was no. They live in such harmony, and in still some areas today, it's still the same.
And yet colonizers throughout the world seem to feel this need to suppress local cultures, don't they?
Yes, they do around the globe, and I don't know why.
I've never understood why either. I really, you know, I was hoping you'd understand that for me.
The only thing that I can think of is that it doesn't seem the way someone should live to them. And that's the only reason that I can really see it. It doesn't make sense.
There has to be an element of fear in it, Shelley, I would think, the human weakness of fear of the unknown.
Absolutely. Fear is in there, very much so. Fear of, I think it's just the non-understanding. It's the fear of all the traditions. It's the deep knowledge as well, because with cultures, indigenous cultures around the world, comes deep knowledge, and it's not surface. It's quite deep. So to learn that, it takes a lot of work as well.
Well, you know, and also, and I'm just kind of speculating here, but the indigenous cultures of long standing have evolved self-contained methods of explaining the world, of regulating society, of keeping things, you know, they find a balance. And in a way, the message that sends to a colonizer is, we don't need you. And that's that frightens them.
Absolutely. And also the strength in the simplicity of life.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, obviously, I was adopted at birth, so I've been grown up both ways now.
Mm-hmm.
In a non-Indigenous family who were very beautiful people, and then they took me back home, and I've been up there for 19 years learning language, songs, dances, and I suppose I've got a pretty good view of both now, of deep traditional culture and, of course, of the Western ways now of the world.
And, you know, I think what that does, Shelley, is it keeps you from having an oversimplified view, don't you think?
Correct, yes. And I think it does definitely help. It helps my family a lot, who often speak three or four or five fluent Aboriginal languages. And it helps them when they get confused. And also sometimes maybe I think I'm the bridge that the Western people, you know, at least, you know, that they can sort of meet and greet and communicate.
Sure.
Not be so frightened.
Well, each language is home to a set of ideas, right? Is that what you gain when you learn, for instance, an Aboriginal language?
Yes, it is. And it's also understanding, well, one, there was no please. Everything was good or not good. The terminology of speaking those languages of what you would say. And, as I said, the depth in those words and the very little words that are used at times. Blows me away, fascinates me, because everything is precious, and even those words with the old people. So often we can sit for an hour and nobody speaks. And then when the moment comes, that's when the words, but there might only be five, and that was all you needed.
Yeah. Well, how does all this, you know, how are you able to, through theater, convey the, you know, the depth of culture that you're alluding to?
It's through the audio and the visual.
Uh-huh.
So there's a huge visual component to this show.
You're rear projecting photographs in some of the videos that I saw, right?
Absolutely. And those visuals or those imagery, the film,
mm-hmm.
tells the story of the song.
Oh, that's that's a window into the language then, isn't it?
Yes, and the story of the landscape and the seasons. And you'll also see the story of the struggles. So we move from where my family live in Kakadu National Park,
mm-hmm.
in the top end of Australia, and then we'll move into more of the urban areas of the big cities, and where Indigenous people are now living in that urbanized environment.
Well, it's a world that will be very far from what most of us have ever known. It sounds fascinating. Thank you, Shirley.
Thank you, Chris.
You bet. Pleasure speaking with you. Shelley Morris is a member of Black Arm Band, whose performance of Dirt Song will be at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center this Thursday, the Big Island's Kahilu Theater on Friday, and at the Hawaii Theater in Honolulu on Saturday. Black Arm Band is an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organization and one of Australia's leading performing arts companies.
Bog dale ambe wen kan me na gale go jap man bon pure bi Aloha, this is John Zach with news of an inauguration. On February 14th, we'll be introducing a new classical music show made right here in the islands. The show is called Classical Pacific and features more of the repertoire of the Western classical canon as performed by artists and orchestras of the Pacific region. I'll be your host and I look forward to voyaging with you during your afternoon commute. Starting February 14th on HBR2, your home for classical music.
And we just want to remind you again that coming up at 9 o'clock, we'll have NPR's coverage of President Obama's press conference. That's happening at 9 o'clock in just a couple of minutes. But that gives us time to say goodbye and to let you know that coming up tomorrow, Tim Vanderveer will be joining us, the chair of the Democratic Party of Hawaii, looking at the power of the positive gathering that's going to be happening a little later this week. Also, a forward look at taxes through the eyes of Tom Yamachika, the director of the Tax Foundation of Hawaii.
And there's a choral tribute to Cole Porter. We'd like to hear from you. You can call us at our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. Our BKOZHPR.
That's if you want to get to me. And if you missed any of the show or you want to hear something again, you can always do that by going to our archive. There are lots of links to more information about guests and topics there, too. Just look under talk shows for the conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you back here in the morning with more of the conversation.